Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Dark Apprentice, Volume 2 of the Jedi Academy Trilogy by Kevin J. Anderson. The huge orange sphere of the gas planet Yavin heaved itself over the horizon of its fourth moon. Soft, misty light shone across the ever-stirring jungles and the ancient stone temples. Luke Skywalker used a Jedi refreshing technique to remove weariness from his body. He had slept soundly, but the future of the New Republic and the fate of the galaxy weighed heavily upon him. Luke stood atop the squared pyramid of the great temple that had been abandoned millennia before by the lost Masasi race. During their early struggles against the Empire, the Alliance had built a secret base in the ruins, from which they had launched their desperate attack against the first Death Star. Now, 11 years after the Rebels' departure, Luke had returned to the fourth moon of Yavin. Now he was a Jedi master. He would be the first of a new generation, like those who had protected the Republic for 1,000 generations. The old Jedi Knights had been respected and powerful until Darth Vader and the Emperor had slaughtered virtually all of them. Luke had received support from Mon Mothma, the New Republic's chief of state, to seek others who had a potential to use the Force, trainees who might become part of a new order of Jedi. Luke had managed to bring 12 students to his academy on Yavin 4, but he felt uncertain about the best way to train them. His own instruction by Obi-Wan and Yoda had been abbreviated, and Luke had since discovered facets of Jedi lore that made him realize just how much he still did not know. Even a great Jedi like Obi-Wan Kenobi had failed with his student and had let Anakin Skywalker become a monster named Darth Vader. Now Luke was expected to instruct others and make no mistakes.
Do or do not, Yoda had said. There is no try.
Luke closed his eyes and let his hands hang at his side, his fingers spread. He let his mind open and relax. He drew strength from the Force, touching ripples made by the life forms crowding the jungles below. With heightened senses, he could hear the rustle of millions of leaves, twigs scraping, small animals scurrying through the underbrush. The plants grew, the animals flourished. The moon awakened to a new day. Yavin 4 was alive, and Luke Skywalker felt energized. Listening intently, he heard 2 people approaching far off in the dense foliage. They moved quietly, but he could sense the change in the jungle as 2 of his Jedi candidates made a path through the undergrowth. He had sent them off into the wilderness to sense and study other life forms touching the Force. Luke decided to go down to meet his pupils. As he turned to re-enter the echoing stone halls of the temple, Luke looked up at the sky to see the streaking trails of a shuttlecraft descending through the humid atmosphere. He realized with a start that the Academy was due for another delivery of supplies. Luke had been so focused on training new Jedi that he had lost touch with galactic politics. And what was happening with Han, Leia, and their children, he hoped the pilot would bring news. He shrugged down the hood of his brown Jedi cloak. The garment was too warm for the jungle humidity, but Luke had stopped noticing minor physical discomfort. When the rebels had first set up their hidden base in the Masasi Temple, they had scoured the thick plant life from the chambers. Across the river stood another prominent temple, and according to orbital surveys, more structures lay buried under the implacable vegetation. But the Alliance had been far too wrapped up in its war against the Empire to bother with detailed archaeological inspections. The vanished race of temple builders remained as much a mystery now as when the rebels had first set foot on Yavin 4. The temple's flagstone corridors were uneven but remarkably unscathed after centuries of exposure to the elements. Luke took a turbo lift from the pinnacle down past the 3rd level, where other students slept or meditated in the early morning. Luke's Jedi Academy was by no means luxurious. In fact, it was barely even comfortable. He had not repaired all the damage caused by time, but he had refurbished the glow panels, water systems, and food prep facilities the Alliance had installed. When Luke reached the ground level of the temple, the partially raised hangar bay doors stood like the dark slit of a mouth. Luke walked past the hangar bay and outside into the jungle. His timing was perfect. As he walked through the lush foliage, he heard his 2 Jedi trainees approach. Tall, dark Gantoris parted heavy branches and came forward to meet Luke. His high forehead had been shaven clean of eyebrows. His skin looked chapped and weathered. On the hellish world of Il-Sha, Gantoris had used an innate talent with the Force to keep a small group of forgotten colonists alive. Gantoris had had nightmares of a terrible dark man who would tempt him with power and then destroy him. At first he had thought Luke was that man. Behind Gantoris came Streen, the second candidate Luke had found in his Jedi search. As the trainees bowed, Luke clasped their hands. "Welcome back. Tell me what you've learned."
"We found another Mishashi temple," Streen said breathlessly.
"Yes," Gantoris said. "The new temple isn't as large as this one, but it seems more potent somehow. It's made of obsidian, sitting out in the middle of a shallow, glassy lake with a tall statue of a great lord."
"A site of great power," Streen said.
"I felt the power, too." Gantoris tossed his thick braid behind him. "We should learn all we can about the Mishashi race. They seem to have been very powerful, but they vanished entirely. What happened to them? Is there something we need to fear?" Luke nodded gravely. He, too, had sensed the power in the temples. He knew the dark power that Gantoris had detected, and although he told his students they must share what they learned, Luke felt that certain knowledge could be deadly. Darth Vader had discovered the wrong kind of knowledge. Luke clapped his hands on their shoulders. "Come inside, take a drink. A supply shuttle is landing, so let's go greet our guest." When they reached the cleared landing pad, R2-D2 waited next to the grid control kiosk, chittering coordinates to a descending X-23 Starworker space barge that had seen better days. The hull of the space barge muttered to itself as it settled. With a coughing hiss, the rear cargo doors slid apart slowly. Bluish-white light shone down on crates and boxes wrapped in storage nets or bolted to a wall, food, communications equipment, clothing, and amenities. A narrow ramp extended with a groan of pistons and rollers from the raised pilot compartment. A silhouette of a man appeared on the ramp. He descended, yanking his white helmet off. Luke grinned. "Wedge! Doesn't the New Republic have anything better for its generals to do? A delivery driver in space?" Luke embraced Wedge Antilles in the greeting of two friends who had not seen each other in far too long. "You've got to admit I'm qualified for the job," Wedge said. "I've been tidying up after the Imperials, doing demolition work in the armpit of Imperial City and cleaning up wrecked spacecraft in orbit around Coruscant. I figured a delivery driver is better than a garbage man." Gantoris came forward from the cargo bay and gave Wedge a quick, almost brutal handshake as he locked eyes with the pilot. "General Antilles, have you any word from my people? I trust they have all been safely shuttled to their new home on Dantooine." "Yes, Gantoris. They're all settled in, doing fine. We drop-lifted an entire settlement of self-erecting living modules. We sent them programming units and agricultural droids so they could establish a viable colony right away. Dantooine is a very mild planet. Plenty of animals to hunt and native vegetation to eat. Trust me, they'll be much more comfortable than they were on Il-Sha." Gantoris nodded solemnly. "That I do not doubt." "Gantoris, Streen, please start unloading the supplies. I don't think you'll have trouble lifting the crates with a little nudge from the Force. Consider it a test." Luke clapped his friend on the shoulder. "I'm starving for news, Wedge. How are Leia and Han? How's Mon Mothma? How are things on Coruscant? And when is Han going to bring Kip Duron to my training center?" Wedge shook his head at the volley of questions. "Kip will be here, Luke. Don't worry. He spent most of his life in the spice mines of Kessel, and he's only been out a month. Han's trying to show the kid how to live a little first." Luke remembered the dark-haired teen Han had rescued from the black spice mines. When Luke had used a Jedi testing technique to see if Kip had potential to use the Force, the boy's response had knocked Luke across the room. In his entire Jedi search, Luke had never encountered such power. "And what about Leia?"
She seems to be spending more and more time with her duties as Minister of State. Mon Mothma has been handing off a lot of important responsibilities to Leia, while she herself stays in her private chambers and rules from a distance. It's got a lot of people disturbed."
That behavior seemed highly unusual for the strong, compassionate ruler Luke remembered. "And how's Leia handling it?"
"Leia's doing a wonderful job, but she's trying to do too much, if you ask me."
Luke nodded.
"And what about you, Wedge? You going to be a delivery driver the rest of your career?"
Wedge smiled, and then with a flick of his wrist, he tossed his helmet up the ramp and into the open cockpit. It clacked and thumped across the floor.
"No. In fact, I came here because I have a new assignment. I won't get a chance to see you again for some time. The New Republic Council feels that Dr. Kwee-Zooks may be in danger from espionage. Admiral Dalla is still out there somewhere with her fleet of Imperial Star Destroyers. And any time now, I expect her to start blasting planets at random with hit-and-run strikes. She may try to get Kui back. Luke nodded gravely. Kui Zoox had been the top scientist in the Imperial Research Facility that Admiral Dalla's ships had guarded. If Admiral Dalla doesn't want Dr. Zoox back, I'm sure someone else will. Yala, that's why I've been assigned as her personal bodyguard and escort. In the meantime, the Council still hasn't decided what to do with the Sun Crusher weapon that Han captured from Dalla. That's just scratching the surface of everything going on back on Coruscant.
Fidgeting from the long voyage in the expanded B-wing fighter, Leia Organa Solo rode in silence beside Admiral Akbar as the ship plunged through hyperspace. Being Minister of State kept Leia on the move, shuttling from diplomatic event to ambassadorial reception to political emergency. Dutifully, she hopped across the galaxy, putting out fires and helping Mon Mothma hold together a fragile alliance in the vacuum left by the fall of the Empire. In her younger days, Leia had devoted her life to the rebellion. Now, though, she felt torn between her duties as Minister of State and her duties as Han Solo's wife and as mother to three children. She had allowed the New Republic to come first, this time, again. Beside her in the cockpit, Admiral Akbar moved his amphibious hands fluidly as he manipulated several control levers. "Dropping out of hyperspace now," he said. The salmon-colored alien swiveled his gigantic glassy eyes from side to side as if to take in every detail of his craft. He seemed an integral part of the gangly craft that appeared to be all wings and turbolaser turrets mounted around a dual cockpit. Akbar's crew of fish-like calamarians, led by his chief starship mechanic, Terpfin, had expanded the former one-man craft into Akbar's personal diplomatic shuttle, adding a single passenger seat. Through the curved dome of the cockpit windows, Leia watched as multicolored knots of hyperspace evaporated into a star-strewn panorama. The sublight engines kicked in and the B-wing streaked toward the planet Vortex. "Beautiful," Leia said, peering out the viewport to the planet beneath them. The blue and metallic gray ball hung alone in space, moonless. Its atmosphere showed complex embroideries of cloud banks and storm systems, racing spirals of clouds that swirled in horrendous gales. Leia remembered her astronomical briefings about Vortex. The sharp tilt of the planet's axis produced severe seasonal changes. At the onset of winter, a vast polar cap formed rapidly from gases that froze out of the atmosphere. The sudden drop in pressure caused immense air currents, like a great flood going down a drain. Clouds and vapor streamed southward in a battering ram to fill the empty zone where the atmosphere had solidified. The Vors, hollow-boned humanoids with a rack of lacy wings on their backs, went to ground during storm season, taking shelter in half-buried hummock dwellings. To celebrate the winds, though, the Vors had established a cultural festival renowned throughout the galaxy. Deciding to review the details one more time before they landed and the diplomatic reception began, Leia touched the icons etched into the synthetic marble frame of her datapad. A translucent image shimmered and grew out of the silvery screen in a miniaturized projection of the Cathedral of Winds. Defying the hurricane gales that thrashed through their atmosphere, the Vors had built a tall, ethereal structure that had resisted the fierce storm winds for centuries. Delicate and intricate, the Cathedral of Winds rose like a castle made of eggshell-thin crystal. Thousands of passageways wound through hollow chambers and turrets and spires. Sunlight glittered on the structure, reflecting the rippling fields of wind-blown grasses that sprawled across the surrounding plains. At the beginning of storm season, gusts of wind blew through thousands of different-sized openings in the hollow walls, whipping up a reverberating, mournful music through pipes of various diameters. The wind music was never the same twice, and the Vors allowed their cathedral to play only once each year. During the concert, thousands of Vors flew into or climbed through the spires and windpipes, opening and closing air passages to mold the music into a sculpture, a work of art created by the weather systems of the storm planet and the Vor people. Decades before, objecting to the excesses of the Empire, the Vors had sealed the holes in their cathedral and refused to let the music play for anyone. But this season, they had invited representatives from the New Republic to come and listen. A Vor voice crackled over the comm channel.
"New Republic craft, we are transmitting landing coordinates that take into account wind shear and storm systems along your descent. Our atmospheric turbulence is quite unpredictable and dangerous. Please follow precisely."
"Understood." Staring ahead, Akbar took his B-wing into the swirling atmosphere of Vortex, straight toward the storm systems.
Akbar knew that humans could not read expressions on Calamarian faces. He hoped Leia did not realize how uneasy he felt flying through such hellish weather patterns. Leia did not know that Akbar had volunteered to take the mission because he trusted no other person to pilot someone as important as the Minister of State. The craft began to rattle and jitter. His stomach lurched as a sudden updraft let them plunge until he managed to wrestle control back. Blurry fists of high-rising clouds pummeled the transparisteel viewports.
New Republic craft, we show you off course. Please advise.
Akbar turned his left eye to double-check the coordinate display and saw that the starfighter had indeed veered off course. Calm and focused, he tried to force the craft back onto the appropriate vector. He couldn't believe he had gone so far astray unless he had misread the coordinates in the first place. As he yanked the B-wing toward a wall of spiraling clouds, a blast of gale-force winds hammered them into a roll and slammed Akbar against his pilot seat. He hauled with all his strength upon the levers, firing stabilizer jets in a counterclockwise maneuver to counteract the spin. The B-wing responded, finally slowing its crazed descent. Akbar looked up to see himself surrounded by a whirlwind of mist. He had no idea which direction was up or down. Suddenly the clouds peeled away like a wet rag ripped from his eyes. The wind-whipped plains of vortex spread out below, furred with golden brown and purple grasses. Concentric circles of bunker-like vor shelters surrounded the center of their civilization. He heard Leia gasp in a deep wonder that sliced through even her terror. The enormous cathedral of winds glinted with light as clouds marched overhead. The high, lacy structure seemed far too delicate to withstand the storms. Winged creatures swarmed up and down the sides of the fluted chambers. In the distance, he could hear the lilting, eerie notes.
New Republic craft, you are on the wrong course. This is an emergency. You must abort your landing.
With a shock, Akbar saw that the displayed coordinates had changed again. The B-wing did not respond as he fought the controls. Leia stared out the viewport. We're heading straight for the cathedral. One of the aileron struts buckled and snapped from the plasteel hull, dragging power cables as it tore free. Sparks flew and more hull plates ripped up. Akbar strangled an outcry. Suddenly, the control lights flickered and his main cockpit panels went dead. He hit the second auxiliary backup.
I don't understand it, Akbar said. This ship was just reconditioned. My own Calamarian mechanics were the only ones who touched it.
On the crystalline cathedral of winds, multicolored vores scrambled down the sides, fleeing as they saw the craft hurtling toward them. Akbar hauled the controls to the right, to the left. All the power had died. Desperately, he hit the full battery reserves, knowing they could do nothing for the mechanical subsystems, but at least he could lock in a full-power crash shield around the B-wing.
I'm sorry, Leia. Tell them that I'm sorry.
He punched a button on the control panel that cracked open the right side of the cockpit, splitting the hull and blasting free the tacked-on passenger seat. Leia found herself flying through the air. The ejection seat's safety repulsor lifts slowly lowered her toward the pale-hued grasses below. She looked up to see Akbar's B-wing in the last instant before it crashed. The starfighter smoked and whined as it plunged like a metal filing toward a powerful magnet. In a frozen moment, she heard the loud, mournful fluting of winds whistling through thousands of crystalline chambers. The breeze picked up with a gust, making the music sound like a sudden gasp of terror. The winged vores scrambled and attempted to flee, but most could not move quickly enough. Akbar's B-wing plowed into the lower levels of the Cathedral of Winds like a meteor. The booming impact detonated the crystalline towers into a hail of razor-edged spears. The sound of tinkling glass, the roar of sharp broken pieces, the shriek of the wind, the screams of the slashed vores, all combined into the most agonizing sound Leia had ever heard. The polar regions of Coruscant reminded Han Solo of the ice planet Hoth, with one crucial difference. Han was here by choice with his young friend Kip Duron for a vacation, while Leia went off with Admiral Akbar on yet another diplomatic mission. He'd left 3PO and Chewbacca in charge of the twins, Jason and Jaina. Han stood atop the crumpled blue-white ice cliffs. The ever-present auroras in the purplish skies sent rainbow curtains refracting off the ice. He drew in a deep breath of crackling cold air that seemed to curl his nostril hairs. He turned to Kip beside him. About ready to go, kid? For the fifth time, the dark-haired 18-year-old bent over to adjust the fastenings on his turbo skis. Almost. Han leaned forward to peer down the steep turbo ski run of rippled ice, feeling a lump form in his throat, but unwilling to show his anxiety. Blue and white glaciers shone in dim light from the months-long twilight. Below, ice-boring machines had chewed deep tunnels into the thick ice caps. Other excavators had chopped broad terraces on the cliffs,
as they mined centuries-old snowpack, melting it with fusion furnaces to be delivered via titanic water pipelines to the dense metropolitan areas in the temperate zones. "You really think I can do this?" Kip said, straightening and gripping his deflector poles. Han laughed. "Kid, if you can pilot us single-handed through a black hole cluster, I think you can handle a turbo ski slope on the most civilized planet in the galaxy." Kip looked at Han with a smile in his dark eyes. Ever since Han had rescued Kip from the spice mines of Kessel, the young man had clung to him. After years of wrongful Imperial imprisonment, Kip had missed the best years of his life. Han vowed to make up for that. Han held onto the deflector poles and flicked them on. He felt the cushioning repulsor field emanating from each point, making the poles bob in the air to keep his balance. "You're on," Kip fired up his own skis. "But not the kiddie slope." He turned from the wide ice pathway and pointed instead to a side run that branched off over several treacherous ledges, across the scabby ice of a rotten glacier, and finally over a frozen waterfall to a receiving and rescue area. Winking red laser beacons clearly marked the dangerous path.
"No way, Kip! It's much too..."
But Kip launched himself forward and blasted down the slope. Han had no choice but to blast after the boy. Kip kept his balance like an expert, intuitively knowing what to do. After only a second of the thundering descent, Han realized that Kip might be more likely to survive this ride than he was. Ahead, the icy roadway seemed foreshortened and continued at a different elevation far ahead. Han realized the danger an instant before he reached the precipice.
"Cliff!"
Han yelled. Kip bent low as if he had simply become another component of his turbo skis. He tucked his deflector poles close to his sides, then fired up the rear jets of his skis. He rocketed over the edge of the cliff, arcing down in a long, smooth curve to the resumption of the trail. Barely in time, Han activated his own jets and launched himself over empty space. His stomach dropped even faster than gravity could tug him down. Wind ruffled the edges of his parka hood. In front of him, Kip landed smoothly without so much as a wobble and shot down slope. Han had time to take only one gulping breath as the plateau of ice rushed up to meet his turbo skis with a loud crack. He gripped his deflector poles, desperate to maintain his balance. A powdery ribbon of drifted snow curled across their path. Kip hopped up into the air and cleanly missed the drift, but Han plowed straight through. Snow flew into his goggles, blinding him. He jabbed from side to side with his poles. He managed to swipe a gloved hand across his goggles just in time to swerve left and avoid smashing into a monolithic ice outcropping. Ahead, Kip encountered a blocky, rubble-strewn glacier field. He wobbled as he struck hummocks of ice and snow. Behind him, Han muttered complaints and curses. He kept his balance somehow, but Kip had lost ground. Han found himself breathing the boy's wake, pushing closer and faster, and suddenly the race meant something to him again. Afterward, while sitting around in a cantina and swapping stories, he would somehow convince himself that the whole thing had been a great deal of fun. He found his way to the steep ice waterfall, the final obstacle before the finish line. The edge of the precipice flowed with tendrils of icicles that had built up over centuries during the brief spring thaws. Kip launched himself over the edge of the frozen river, igniting both ski jets. Han did the same, tucking his poles against his ribs, watching the packed snow fly up to strike the bottom of his skis with a loud slap that echoed in unison with the sound of Kip's landing. They both charged forward, then slowed to a stop in front of the cluster of prefab huts. Kip peeled down the hood of his parka and started laughing. Han held onto his deflector poles, feeling his body tremble with relief and an overdose of excitement. Then he, too, began chuckling. "That was really stupid, kid."
"Oh?" Kip shrugged. "Who was stupid enough to follow me? Hey, maybe we should ask 3PO to tell us the odds of successfully negotiating that slope when we get back."
Han shook his head and gave a lopsided grin. "I'm not interested in odds. We did it. That's what counts." Kip stared across the frozen distance into something only he seemed to see.
"I'm glad we've had so much fun, Han. I've done a lifetime's worth of healing since you rescued me."
Han felt uncomfortable at the thick emotion he heard in Kip's voice. He tried to lighten the mood.
"Well, kid, you had as much to do with our escape as I did."
Kip didn't seem to hear.
"I've been thinking about what Luke Skywalker said when he found my ability to use the Force. I only know a little bit about it, but it seems to be calling me. I could do a huge service to the New Republic. The Empire ruined my life and destroyed my family. I wouldn't mind getting a chance to strike back."
Han swallowed, knowing what the boy was trying to say.
"So, you think you're ready to go stay with Luke and the other Jedi trainees?"
Kip nodded.
"I'd rather stay here and have fun for the rest of my life, but..."
"You deserve it, you know,"
Han said. But Kip shook his head.
"I think it's time I start taking myself seriously. If I do have this gift for using the Force, I can't let it go to waste. Han gripped the young man's shoulder and squeezed hard. I'll see you get a good flight to Yavin 4. Han looked up as a messenger droid approached, streaking like a chromium projectile over the ice fields. The droid arrowed straight for them. It snapped open a scanning panel and spoke.
General Solo, please confirm identification. Voice match will be sufficient.
Oh, I'm on vacation. I don't want to bother with any diplomatic mess right now.
Voice match confirmed, thank you. Prepare to receive encoded message.
The droid hovered as it projected a holographic image onto the clean snow.
Han? Mon Mothma said.
He noticed immediately that she had called him by his first name instead of his more formal rank. A fist of dread clenched his stomach.
I'm sending you this message because there has been an accident. Admiral Akbar's shuttle crashed on the planet Vortex. Leia and Admiral Akbar are safe and unharmed. But the entire structure was destroyed. So far, at least 358 Vors are confirmed dead in the wreckage. This is a tragic day for us, Han. Come home to Imperial City. I think Leia might need you as soon as she returns.
Down in the repair bays of the revamped Imperial Palace on Coruscant, Lando Calrissian couldn't imagine how Chewbacca managed to cram his enormous furry body inside the Falcon's narrow maintenance crawlway. Standing in the corridor, Lando saw the Wookiee as a tangle of brown fur wedged between the emergency power generator, the acceleration compensator, and the anti-concussion field generator. Chewbacca dropped a hydro spanner, which landed in a completely inaccessible spot. In looking for it, the Wookiee banged his shaggy head on a coolant pipe.
No, no, Chewbacca, Lando tried to point toward the circuitry. That goes here and this goes there.
Chewbacca grumbled back, disagreeing. Look, Chewie, I know this ship like the back of my hand, too. I owned her for quite a few years, you know.
All right, have it your way. I can work the access hatches on the outside hull. I'll retrieve your hydro spanner.
Lando turned and made his way to the entry ramp, stomping down into the cacophony of shouted requests and engine noises in the starship mechanic bay. Admiral Akbar's carefully picked crew of Calamarian starship mechanics were overseeing special modifications to small vessels in the New Republic fleet. Terpfen, Akbar's chief mechanic, wandered from ship to ship, status board in hand, verifying requested repairs and scrutinizing the work with his glassy fish eyes. Lando pried open the access hatch on the Falcon's outer hull. The hydro spanner clattered out and fell into his outstretched hands.
Got it, Chewbacca, he shouted.
The Wookiee's answer was muffled inside the cramped access hatch. Lando looked at the scorch marks along the Falcon's battered hull. The ship seemed to be one massive collection of patches and repairs. He ran a calloused hand along the hull, caressing the metal.
Hey! What are you doing to my ship?
Lando jerked his hand away from the Falcon and looked around guiltily to see Han Solo approaching. Chewbacca bellowed a greeting from the maintenance crawlway. Han looked unaccountably angry.
I need my ship right now. She ready to fly?
Lando put his hands at his side.
I was just making some repairs and modifications, old buddy. What's the problem?
Han turned to the Wookiee.
Chewie, we've got to fly right away. Why did you let this clown mess around with my engines?
Wait a minute, Han. This used to be my ship, you know.
Lando had no idea what had provoked such anger in his friend. Besides, who rescued this ship from Kessel? Who saved your tail from the Imperial fleet? At that moment, C-3PO marched stiffly into the mechanic bay.
Ah, greetings, General Calrissian.
Lando ignored the droid and continued scolding Han.
I lost the Lady Luck rescuing your ship. I think that deserves a little gratitude, don't you?
Han looked ready to explode.
My problem is you've been sabotaging my ship. I don't ever want you touching her again. Do you understand? Get your own ship. Seems to me that with the million credit rewards you got at the blob races on Umgul, you could buy just about any ship you want. Stop messing around with mine.
An excellent idea, sir, 3PO added helpfully.
Be quiet, 3PO, Lando said. I don't want to buy another ship, old buddy. If I can't have the Lady Luck, I want the Falcon. Your wife is the Minister of State, Han. You can have the government provide you with any sort of transport you want.
Why not get yourself a new fighter right from the Calamarian shipyards?
I don't want any old ship. The Falcon is mine.
Lando glowered at Han.
You won it from me in a sabacc game. And to tell you the truth, old buddy, I've always suspected you cheated in that game.
Han grew livid.
You're accusing me of cheating? I have been called a scoundrel before, but never a cheat.
And you're a pirate,
Lando said, bunching his fists at his side. As Han and Lando closed to within striking distance, 3PO wriggled in between them.
Excuse me, sirs, but might I make a suggestion?
Could you perhaps simply play another game of Sabacc to settle this issue once and for all?
3PO turned his glowing optical sensors first at Lando and then at Han.
Han said, I just came down here to get my ship, but now you've made it into a point of honor. All right, Han, let's do it before you lose your nerve.
You're going to lose more than nerve before this game is over.
As Lando set up the cards in the Sabacc table, Han ushered the last of the off-duty bureaucrats toward the door of the small lounge.
Out! Come on! We need to use this space for a while.
They grumbled and objected in a variety of languages, but Han assisted them through the entryway with gentle shoves, saying,
File a complaint with the New Republic.
And he closed and sealed the door, turning to Lando.
You ready yet?
At the Sabacc table, Lando spread out a handful of rectangular cards with crystalline screens sandwiched between metal layers.
Ready when you are, buddy.
But he looked uneasy.
Han, we don't really have to do this.
Han sniffed the air, frowning at the cloying smells of deodorizing mists and ambassadorial perfumes.
Yes, I do. Leia's been in an accident on one of her diplomatic missions, and I want to be the one to escort her back home, not some hospital ship. Leia's hurt?
Lando stood up in surprise.
So that's what's been bothering you. Forget it. Take the ship. I was just kidding anyway. We'll do this some other time.
No. We'll do it now, or you'll never be off my case. 3PO meticulously dealt 5 of the flat metallic cards each to Lando and to Han.
As you know, this is random Sabacc, a combination of variant forms of the game. There are 5 different sets of rules, shifted by chance and changed at random time intervals as determined by the computer's random generator. That's me.
We know the rules, Han growled, but he wasn't so certain. We also know the stakes.
Lando's deep, flinty eyes met his across the table.
Winner takes the Falcon. Loser takes Coruscant public transit from now on.
Very well, sirs. Activate your cards. The first player to reach a score of 100 points will be declared the winner.
3 hands and 3 rule changes later, Han and Lando stared in suspense as the images on the cards that made up their hands swirled and changed again, flickering from one value to another in a blur until they stabilized one by one. Finally, Lando found himself looking at low-denomination numeric cards, nothing at all spectacular, while Han got the best deal he had seen throughout the entire game, all face cards, Demise, Endurance, the Star, and the Queen of Air and Darkness, along with a balance card. His score handily passed the goal, leaving Lando in the dust. He cheered at the same instant 3PO declared another change of rules. Han glared at the golden droid, waiting.
This hand will be scored under the Eclesis Fig variation.
Han and Lando looked at each other, mouthing the words.
What is the Fig variation? Han asked.
In the final round, the scores of all odd-numbered face cards are subtracted instead of added to the final score. This means, Master Solo, that while you gain 10 points for Endurance and the Queen of Air and Darkness, you forfeit a total of 41 for Balance, the Star, and Demise. I'm afraid you lose, sir.
Han blinked in shock at his half-empty glass of spiced ale. Lando shifted uncomfortably.
I'll take good care of her, Han, not a scratch.
Without another word, Han went to the door of the lounge, unsealed it, and walked out into the echoing halls. With black-gloved hands clasped behind her back, Admiral Dalla stood at attention on the bridge of the Imperial Star Destroyer, Gorgon. In front of the bridge viewport, brilliant gases illuminated by a knot of blue giant stars turned the Cauldron Nebula into a spectacular light show. Beside her, in parking formation, hung the Basilisk and the Manticore. The ionized gases played havoc with ship's sensors, making the nebula a perfect hiding place for her 3 fully armed battleships. Dalla heard a tentative bootstep behind her and turned to face Commander Kratos.
Yes, Commander?
As she moved, her mane of coppery hair trailed behind her like the tail of a comet. Kratos snapped off a perfect salute and remained standing one step below her observation platform.
Admiral, as of 0900 hours, we have completed our assessment of the losses suffered during our battle at Kessel. Together we have lost a total of 3 TIE squadrons, and of course, all hands and resources on board that Hydra.
The Hydra, Dalla's 4th Star Destroyer, had been torn apart in one of the Maw Cluster's black holes. It had been Dalla's first significant loss in combat, 1/4 of her destructive capability wiped out by Han Solo and the traitorous scientist Kwee-Zoots, who had stolen the Sun Crusher superweapon and fled the Empire's closely guarded Maw installation.
However, 40 TIE fighters from the Hydra did manage to reach safety inside the other Star Destroyers, which makes up somewhat for the other losses.
Dala's Star Destroyers had emerged from the Maw Cluster expecting to engulf and obliterate Han Solo, but her ships had run headlong into Kessel's ragtag fleet. Though her Star Destroyers had destroyed nearly two-thirds of Kessel's ships, the Basilisk had suffered severe damage and had to be linked with the Gorgon's navicomputers for escape to a secret location in the Cauldron Nebula. "What is the status of repairs to the Basilisk?" she asked. Kratos clicked his heels smartly as if pleased to give good news and went down the lengthy list of repairs that had been made, finishing with, "In short, Admiral, I believe our entire fleet is ready for battle again." Dala tried unsuccessfully to stop a smile from creeping across her lips. "If I might ask a question, Admiral..." Kratos glanced around to see the other personnel at their stations, every head turned studiously away from the conversation. "With the information we gained from interrogating Han Solo, we know that the Emperor is no longer alive, that Darth Vader and Grand Moff Tarkin are also dead."
Dala spoke for him. "You are wondering, Commander, who our Commander-in-Chief is?"
Kratos nodded vigorously.
"Grand Admiral Thrawn has been killed, as has Warlord Zinge. We know of several commanders still fighting over the remnants of the Empire, but they seem more interested in destroying each other than in battling the rebellion. If I may make a suggestion, the Imperial Military Academy on Corrida still appears to be stable and loyal, with a great many weapons at their disposal. Perhaps it would be best to..."
"I don't think so."
Dala had been trained and trounced in the harsh military academy on Corrida. Because she was female, she had been passed over for promotion after promotion. She had been given the worst assignments, and that had only increased her drive to succeed. Finally, she had created a false identity for herself through Corrida's vast computer networks and used that identity in combat simulation rooms. She had won repeatedly, creating breakthrough tactics that had been adopted by many of the Imperial Army's ground assault forces. After Moff Tarkin had discovered Dala's true identity and realized her talent, he had secretly whisked her away, using his new authority as Grand Moff of the Outer Rim Territories. He had promoted her to the rank of Admiral, as far as she knew, the only female Admiral in the entire Imperial fleet. He had given her command of 4 Star Destroyers assigned to guard the super-secret think tank inside the Black Hole Cluster. Now that she had come out with her battleships ready to devastate any planet loyal to the rebellion, Dala could not conceive of handing over that authority to her former persecutors on Corrida. She took a deep breath again and faced Commander Kratos. "Since the factions seem to have forgotten that our true enemy is the rebellion, we will set an example for them. We must focus their attention on the appropriate enemy, the rebels. I think our best chance is to rely on hit-and-run tactics, guerrilla warfare. We have 3 Star Destroyers. That's enough to wipe out civilizations on any number of worlds. We must hit fast and run fast. We will continue to pound the rebels for as long as we can." She glanced around the bridge to see that all personnel stood staring at her, some with wide eyes and gaping mouths, others grinning. Her crew had been bottled up in the Maw, ready to fight but denied any chance at action because they were forced to guard the group of prima donna weapons scientists. Dala glanced out at the Cauldron Nebula, saw the bright lights of other star systems piercing the haze of ionized gas. Many targets waited out there. She turned to the navigator's station. "Lieutenant, I want you to plot a course for the last known shipping lanes closest to our position."
"Yes, Admiral."
The lieutenant practically leapt toward his station. "Inform all personnel on the 3 ships," Dala said. A bold grin lit her face. She felt as if her blood had become molten copper. The fight was about to begin.
"Let's go hunting,"
Dala said, and a spontaneous cheer erupted from the bridge crew. It wasn't long before Dala was able to make her first move. Her ships intercepted a Corellian transport, and Dala interrogated the captain. As she had suspected, he was delivering supplies and equipment for the rebellion to a small colony. Dantooine became the Gorgon's next destination. Luke Skywalker, Jedi Master, gathered his 12 students in the grand audience chamber of the Masasi Temple. He watched the students file toward him along the broad promenade. Streen and Gantoris moved first, side by side. Of all those Luke had gathered at his Jedi training center, Gantoris had so far shown the most progress, the most inner strength. Yet the man from Eel Shah did not seem to realize that he stood at a crossroads. Gantoris would soon need to decide exactly how he would proceed in his growth with the Force. Behind Gantoris and Streen came Kirana Tee, one of the young and powerful witches of Dathomir. She had been instrumental in helping him recover an ancient wrecked space station, the Chunthor, in which resided many records of old Jedi training, records that Luke had studied to develop exercises for his Jedi trainees. Beside Kirana T came Dorsk 81, a bald, green and yellow-skinned humanoid from a world where all family units were genetically identical, cloned, and raised to carry on the status quo. Though Dorsk 81, the 81st reincarnation of the same genetic attributes, seemed identical to his ancestors in every way, his mind worked differently. His thoughts moved along different paths, and he could feel the Force working through him. Then came Kam Solusar, an older man, son of a Jedi that Vader had slaughtered long ago. As the rest of the candidates gathered at the raised platform, Luke shrugged back his hood and tried to mask his pride at seeing the group. If he successfully completed their training, they would form the core of a new order of Jedi Knights, champions of the Force, to help protect the New Republic against dark times. Standing at the podium, Luke found the core of peace inside him that allowed him to speak with a firm voice. "I have brought you here to study and to learn, but I myself am still learning. Every living thing must continue to learn until it dies. Those who cease to learn die that much sooner. Perhaps it was misleading when I called this an academy for Jedi. Though I will teach you everything I know, I don't want you merely to listen to me lecture. Your training will be a landscape of self-discovery. I will call this place Apraxium. This word, made up of ancient roots, was first used by the Jedi scholar Karena, distilling the concept of learning combined with action. Our Apraxium, then, is a place for the learning of action." Luke repositioned a small, translucent cube on the dais behind him. He ran his fingers over the cool surface of the ancient knowledge repository Leia had stolen from the resurrected Emperor. The Jedi Holocron. "We will invoke a past Jedi master from the Holocron. Let us see what stories it has for us this morning." He activated the precious artifact. In the distant past, it had been traditional for each Jedi master to compile his life's knowledge and store it within a great repository such as this, which was then passed to one of his students. An image formed both inside and outside the cube, a half-tangible projection that was more than just a stored bit of data. It was an interactive representation of the Jedi master, a stubby alien, part insectile, part crustacean. It seemed to be bent with age or too much gravity. Its head extended into a long funnel like a beak from which dangled whiskery protuberances. Close-set glassy eyes stared like glittering pinpoints of knowledge. The creature leaned on a long wooden staff, its legs spindly and knobby, as it swiveled its funnel-like face to contemplate the new audience.
"I am Master Vodosios Vas."
"Master Vodo," Luke said, "I am Master Skywalker, and these are my apprentices. You have seen many things and recorded many thoughts. We'd be honored if you could tell us something we should know." The image of Master Vodo Siosk Bas hung his beak-like head on a jointed elbow of neck as if thinking. Luke knew that the Holocron was simply uploading and sifting through reams of data, choosing an appropriate story through a personality algorithm stored with the Jedi Master's image.
"I must tell you of the great Sith War that occurred..."
Here the image paused as the Holocron assessed the current situation.
4,000 years before your time, this war was caused by a student of mine, Exar Kun, who found forbidden teachings of the ancient Sith here on Yavin 4. He imitated the ways of the long-fallen Sith and used them to form his own philosophy of the Jedi Code, a distortion of all we know to be true and right. With this knowledge, Exar Kun established a vast and powerful brotherhood and claimed the title of the first Dark Lord of the Sith."
Luke stiffened. "Others have claimed that title even to this time, including Darth Vader."
"Exar Kun worked his invisible threads into the fabric of the Old Republic, bringing downfall through treachery and his distorted abilities with the Force."
Master Vodo looked at the gathered students. Gantoris seemed incredibly eager to hear more, leaning forward and staring with wide, dark eyes. The image of the long-dead Jedi Master turned to face Luke.
"You must warn your students to beware of the temptations of conquest. That is all I can tell you for now."
The images returned to swirling pearlescence inside its cubicle walls.